myself. I did not want them here in the dark with me. Much as I might claim to disbelieve the fool's dream, his prediction had been too powerful. I thought of Bee's illustration in her book. The blue buck stood on one pan of the scale, the tiny bee on the other, and below it, in her careful script, the words of the red-toothed woman were written, "A worthy exchange." It was. My thoughts wandered. I hoped Nettle's child was growing well. Riddle would be a good father. I hoped Lant and Spark and Purr would understand my decision. I thought of Molly, and wished I could have died in bed with her beside me. The skill was stealing my body's paltry reserves, trying to heal the broken parts while rebuilding the strength I had pushed into the fool. But my body had nothing left to fuel a renewal. I felt like a lamp flame dancing on the last of a wick. I wanted to sleep, but was too uncomfortable. Eventually, I knew sleep would take me, whether I willed it or not. Possibly I was already asleep in this total darkness. Maybe I was already dead.
"I preferred the boredom to this self-pity, and the water to the left of you is warmer now. Don't you smell it, even with your pitiful nose?"
I reached over my head and as far to the left as I could in the darkness. My hand touched water, and it was much warmer than standing water inside a dank tunnel should have been. I strained again, reaching, and the water grew surprisingly hot. The fire brick was a powerful magic. As I drew my hand back, my pack exploded. I was not completely blind, for I knew an instant of gleaming silver light. Water splashed over me, hot enough to scald. I tried to wipe it from my face, but it clung, searing and burning, to both my hands and to my face. It was not water. It sank into me like liquid poured into dry sand, permeating me. And my body sucked it in as if it had always craved this magical stuff. One side of my face, my chest and left arm, and both hands it coated, and then it spread as if it was something alive, seeking to envelop me. I screamed, but not in pain. It was an ecstasy too large for my body to contain. 4 times I gave voice to an experience no human was ever meant to have. Then I lay back, panting and weeping. I could feel it soaking and changing me, claiming and trapping me. I tried again to wipe it from my eyes. It had gone into my mouth when I screamed and up my nose. The burning pleasure of it was so excruciating that it was a new kind of pain. I rubbed my eyes and tried to blink it away, and saw instead a new world in the dark cavern. The gleaming splashes of silver that had erupted had spattered the fallen stonework that pinned me. I also understood what the fool had tried to explain to me, back in Buckkeep Castle, when he spoke of seeing as a dragon might. I saw warmth on the spattered silver and splashed water. I watched it fade as the water cooled. Darkness flowed back in around me. The silver continued to explore me. I lay still, beyond pleasure, beyond pain, beyond time. I closed my eyes. I let go.
"Fitz, do something."
I realized I was still breathing, and with that thought, awareness of my body triggered a rush of all the pains.
"Do what?"
I spoke the words in a dry whisper.
"Verity shaped stone with his silvered hands. The scentless one shaped wood with his silvered fingertips."
Oh. With the tips of my fingers, I explored the fallen beam that trapped my legs. I stroked it. No change that I could feel. I scratched at it with my nails, splinters under my nails. Not pleasant. I smoothed it with my fingertips. I do not know how long it took me to master the process. It was not a physical digging away that was needed, but a persuasion of the wood. I did not compress it with the strength of my hands, nor shear it away, but I came to know the fallen beam very well indeed. It was a physical feat to tighten my belly muscles and curl up enough to reach under the pinning wood. Too often I had to lie back and gather myself again. Silver was not food and water. It gave me strength, but still my body was hungry and thirsty, and so very tired. When my second leg was finally freed, the incredible pain of its reawakening left me weeping and shouting. I slid my body down the stone steps and into shallow water and wallowed about until my head was finally higher than my torso. I crawled up onto fallen debris. I think I fell unconscious for a time. When I woke, the water had receded slightly. I could not stand, and even sitting was a weariness. I decided I would sleep for a time longer.
No, you can sleep after you have seen the sky again. Up, Fitz, up and walk. You cannot rest yet.
It was not my human will, but the wolf in me, that made me struggle to rise. My feet were distant and painful things. There were deep bruises across my legs. The flesh had been compacted and crushed. I could feel that with my fingers, as well as the ragged edge of the sword slash. I was glad I could not see my legs, save as warm shapes. My initial progress was a series of stagger, fall, crawl, rest, stand, stagger, fall. The steps went down forever, and every lurch down was a torment. The fall took me into shallow, briny water. I moved through utter darkness. When my groping hands found a section of wall that seemed less damaged by Spark's blast, I followed along it. Barnacles on the wall and floor cut my flesh. I stupidly realized I was barefoot. When had I lost my boots? The blast had torn my clothes, but my boots? I pushed that aside. It was only pain, and it did not last long. The steps down seemed endless. I was grateful that the water was gradually receding. I do not think I could have forced my way past its resistance. When the steps finally ended and I sloshed through standing water to my knees, I became aware of a different sort of pain. It was not just the skill forcing the healing of my legs. When I touched the sword slash, silver fingers to silver slashed wound, I felt as if I had been patched, like a leather jerkin mended with canvas. It did not feel like my own flesh, but there was no stopping it. I might be able to persuade stone to move and free me, but my own body had a peculiar will of its own. Onward. I had to catch up with the others. The fool would believe I was dead. That was what he would tell them. My poor little girl. I could not blame him. I had thought myself dead.
You would have been if I had not held back some life for us. For me. For you. Mostly for the cub. You must stop taking foolish risks. We need to survive.
How long had I been trapped underground? A tide had been rising when the others fled. It had fallen, risen again, and now was ebbing, I judged. A day gone, at least. Possibly two. I wondered where B and the others might be right now. Had they escaped? Were they even now at sea on Paragon, sailing away from this horrid place, toward home and family? I tried to skill to B. I had as little success as I always did when I reached for her. Trying to skill through the pain and the peculiar silver sensations was like trying to shout when one is breathless and running. I gave it up and trudged on. Catch up with them. Had they encountered the servant's guardsmen? Had the fleeing wights we freed betrayed them? Had they fought and won, or fallen? Had they been taken prisoner? Whenever I wanted to stop and rest, I flogged myself with those thoughts and pushed on. I came to steps. I climbed them. Blackness became dark grey, and then a paler grey. I pushed on toward a paler shape of light, interrupted by lines, and it was a partly open door, overgrown by vegetation. I could barely push past the tangled greenery. Brambles tore at my frayed clothing and skin as I thrust thorny vines aside until I emerged from the hillside thicket and stood under a clear, blue sky. The grass was taller than my knees and mixed with twiggy brush. I collapsed and sat where I was, heedless of the protest of the sword slash across my thigh. I dared myself to look at it. It was sealed with silver, as if I'd patched myself with tar. I prodded it and winced. Under the patch, my body toiled on with its repairs. My vision was marginally clearer. My palms were silver. I stared at them. My hands were skeletal, bones and bulging veins and tendons, all gleaming as if cast in silver. I'd eaten myself to make repairs. My clothing hung on me. I rose and tried to walk on. The ground was uneven, and tufts of grass caught at my dragging feet. I stepped on a flattened thistle and fell over. It was hard to see the tiny pale thorns I picked out of the sole of my bony foot with my silver fingers. I could feel what I could not see, the silver giving me a sensitivity that my hands had never possessed. I looked at my hands in the sunlight. They glittered, gleaming and bright. It was either more silver than Verity had ever possessed, or a much finer quality than he had used. The coating on Verity's hands had reminded me of thick mud. Mine looked as if I wore elegant silver gloves that clung to every line and fold of my hands. I re-inspected the places where the silver had struck. Had the blast so shredded my clothing, or had the silver splashed and eaten it? Silver gleamed on part of my chest, in splotches on my legs. I knew it coated more than half my face. I wondered what it looked like. My eyes? I pushed the thought away. Straggling among the grass were long, crawling threads of clover, both leaves and purple blossoms. Molly had used the flowers to flavor warmed honey and teas. I gathered a handful and put them in my mouth, a faint trace of sweetness and moisture. They helped, but not enough. I managed to stagger upright and stood unsteady on my feet, trying to decide where I was. I was on one of the rolling hills behind the town, I thought. Below me were the ruins of Clara's castle. I stared. It was castle no longer, but only mounded rubble scattered across the end of the peninsula. Bee's fire had not done that. A slow recognition worked into me. The dragons had come. Hebe and Tintaglia. This was the vengeance they had said they would take. Men would have needed months to topple this stronghold so thoroughly, and men tended to keep and exploit what they conquered. Dragon acid had eaten the walls, melting stone and dissolving wood. It looked like a dropped cake. I saw two figures moving over the rubble and spotted another man along the shore, pushing a barrow down what had been the road. It was littered with the wreckage of the buildings that had lined it. So few people. I wondered how many were buried under the falling rubble. Were my people among them? Where was Paragon? Not in the harbor, nor anchored outside it. Paragon was gone. There were no large ships there. Not one. No barrows full of goods moved on the docks. No one strolled the streets of the markets and warehouse areas. All the structures lacked roofs, and the walls leaned drunkenly against one another. There was, however, plenty of wreckage sloshing around the pilings of the docks, and many masts of smaller vessels sticking up above the retreating waves. In the distant sky, something sparkled. Wings of red and blue. Tintaglia and Hebe finished with their destruction and winging home. And beneath them, a sailing ship. Paragon? I dared to hope. But it was leaving. Leaving me here. At the edge of the harbor below, a ship was putting on a sail. I stared at her. No mistaking that stern and house. It was the live ship, Vivacia, departing without me.
Bee!
I shouted her name. And then,
Fool! Don't go! Wait!
Stupid. Stupid, stupid. I drew a deep breath, gathered my strength, and reached out with the skill.
Bee, bee, tell them you hear me. Tell them to turn back. I'm here. Come back.
I felt no sense of her, not even the rush and rip of the skill current. Was my magic as damaged as the rest of me? I tried again, pushing hard, wordlessly, trying for a touch. A wave of vertigo sat me down on the grassy turf. Had she heard me? Were her walls up? I watched the ship, hoping to see the sails change, to see it tack and turn. Was she even on the ship? Did she still exist for me to skill to? If she lived, she had not heard me. The ship moved slowly and gracefully away, leaving me. I stood, shaking with hunger and tormented by thirst, and watched the ship grow smaller. What did I do now? A rising tide of despair threatened to engulf me. I needed to know what had happened, and there was no one to tell me. What should I do?
First, you live, stupid. Eat something besides clover, and drink. Find water.
The wolf in me lived ever in the now. I looked for telltale signs of a stream or spring, taller green grass or bog grass. I saw an area down the hillside that showed much trampling by hooves. Of the flocks I had seen, only 3 sheep remained, cropping the grass near the spring. I went toward it. The area around the welling water was bare of grass and carpeted with sheep dung. I was past caring. The mud rose between my toes as I waded out into a shallow pool and found the coolness where the water had welled from the earth. I scooped up water in my silvered hands. I looked at it, my caution warring with my thirst, and then I drank from my hands, not caring if it silvered my innards. I was still scooping water and drinking it when I heard a caw. I looked up. A flock of ravens are almost always crows, and a single crow is usually a raven. But there was no mistaking Motley with her silver beak. And scarlet plumes? She circled high above me.
Motley!
I cried to her. She cawed back and then slid away from me on the wind, down to the town.
Stupid bird, I said aloud. She saw us. Wait.
Such counsel was very unlike Night Eyes. I went back to drinking water. When my belly would take no more, I waded to the edge of the muddy watering hole, and then out onto cleaner grass.
Can I sleep now?
If you can't eat, sleep, but not out in the open. When did you become so foolish?
When I stopped caring. I did not share that thought with him. It would almost have been a relief to have someone attack me, someone I could throttle and bite and kick. My worry had become anger at everything I didn't know and couldn't control. I sensed her with my wit and turned my head before she landed onto the sheep-cropped sward at my feet. Motley dropped a large piece of something and then did a bobbing crow greeting.
Eat! Eat, silver man!
She urged me. She paused to groom her feathers. They had become even more resplendent, with a few scarlet flight feathers in each wing, and a steel-blue sheen to the black ones.
Silverbeak,
I responded to her, and she tilted her head and gave me a knowing look.
Consorting with dragons again?
I hazarded, and her caw was like a pleased chuckle.
What is this?
I asked, as I stooped to look at a moist brown cube. I didn't want to touch it.
Food!
She told me, and lifted into the air again.
Wait!
I cried after her.
Where are the others? What happened?
She did a circle around me.
Dragons! Lovely, lovely dragons. Paragon is dragons now.
Motley, please, where are my friends?
Some died, some left.
She called the words down.
One comes.
Which some? Left for where? Who comes? Crow! Motley! Come back!
But the crow did not heed my cries. She flew away in a straight line, back to the fallen city, probably back to where she had pilfered the food. If food it was, I picked up the sticky cube and smelled it. A rich brown meat smell came from it.
Eat it!
Night Eye's assurance was all I needed. Without hesitation, I took a bite. It was delicious, salt and beef, a chunk of food almost as big as my fist, and doubtless as much as she could carry. I surrendered my annoyance with her. I still needed to know, but my body said that food was more important than information at the moment. And more water. I went back to the spring. I drank, splashed my face and neck, and then scrubbed at the remaining crust of filth that clung to my trouser legs. Washing my hands had no effect on the silver that coated them. The sheep lifted their heads, and I looked up with them. Prilcop was slowly climbing the hill toward me. A white followed him at a discreet distance. I stood and watched them come. Prilcop regarded me with dismay, and perhaps horror. Did I look so terrible? Of course, I must. When he was close enough that I did not have to shout, I asked, "Who lived?" He stopped.
"Of yours or mine?"
he asked gravely.
"Mine."
His question angered me with its subtle accusation.
"Be and beloved, the boy you had with you, and the young woman."
I tamped down my joy with my next question. "And Lant?"
"The warrior you brought with you? When last I saw your folk, he was not among them. Probably lost in the water when the ship changed into dragons."
Another jolt to my tottering mind. I waded out of the now muddied water and away from the dung-strewn area surrounding it. Prilcop came and walked beside me, but did not offer his arm. I didn't blame him.
"Where did my people go?"
"Another ship came to the harbor and carried them away. They are gone." I met his gaze. His dark eyes were full of anguish.
"Why did you come to me?"
"I saw a crow with a few scarlet feathers. I dreamed of that crow once. When I called to it, it came to me and spoke your name and said I would find you with the sheep." He looked around. "The few that remain," he added, and again I heard that accusing note in his voice. "I saw him with your friends when last I spoke to Beloved."
"Her,"
I corrected.
"You spoke to Beloved?"
The grass under my bare feet was relatively free of sheep dung. I sat down like an old tapestry falling from its hooks. Prilcop was more graceful, but not much. I wondered how old he was. The white he had brought with him didn't sit, but stood at a distance, as if he would flee at any moment.
"Leave the food and the wine, and you can go," Prilcop told him.
The white unslung a canvas bag from one shoulder, dropped it, then turned and ran. Prilcop made a sound between a sigh and a moan. He worked his way to his feet, retrieved the bag, and seated himself beside me again. As he opened it between us, I asked him, "Am I that frightening?"
"You look more statue than man. Something wrought of silver, attached to a skeleton, coated with flesh."
"Did Capra do this to you, or a dragon?"
"My own doing, and no one else's. A magic gone wrong," I told him, for I was too weary to bother with more words than that.
"What happened to be and to Beloved, to everyone else?"
"They believe you dead, all of them. They mourn you savagely."
"Vanity is such a strange thing. They mourned me, and I was warned that they loved me." He spoke words carefully as he dug a cork out of the web-coated bottle of wine. He set it down between us and began to arrange a strange picnic.
"It's good wine, from the best tavern in town. I had to choose from what folk had left behind. The eggs are raw, from a half-fallen chicken house. The apricots are not quite ripe, but the tree was down, so I picked them. The same for the fish. I took it from a fallen smoking rack, and it's still wet inside."
"And you brought it for me?"
"I was gathering food when I saw the crow. I think you are hungrier than I am."
"Thank you." I cared nothing for the condition of the food or its source. I was barely able to restrain myself until he had set out the food on the coarse sack it had been carried in.
"Eat while I talk," he suggested,
and I was happy to comply. The food was as flawed as he said it would be, and I devoured it. Raw eggs are fine, as long as the belly expects them. There were gaps in the tale he told me, but I learned much that calmed my heart. He had seen B with the Fool and Spark and Purr. Lant was possibly lost. Someone had been badly burned. Harder to grasp was that the ship Paragon had sunk. Two dragons had emerged from the waters of the harbor. I had my own thoughts on how that had happened. Other dragons and a scarlet man had come to destroy all of Clarez. I was astounded when he spoke of a black dragon. It had to be Icefire. The scarlet man that Prilcop had glimpsed was probably Rapscow. There were things he did not know and could not explain. I could not imagine how Paragon had found the strength to become dragons. Then I recalled the Fool's words about my missing tube of silver. Tintaglia and Hebe had said they would come as soon as they could, but I was surprised that Icefire had made the journey. Prilcop knew little of the Vivacia, other than that a ship with a living figurehead had come into the bay. The dragons had flown in circles above it, shouting down to it, and then all the folk that remained from those who had arrived on the Paragon had departed on board it. Logic told me that I should be glad they were safely on their way. But being left for dead, even when one has insisted on it, creates a gulch of hurt in the heart. No matter how foolish, it stung that they had gone without me. It echoed painfully how Molly and Burrick had continued their lives when they believed me dead. Stupid, stupid emotion. Would not I have done exactly the same? I pushed my thoughts into a new channel, forced myself to confront the tragedy in Prilcop's eyes. They have treated you badly ever since you returned to Clarez, but I know this is not what you would have wished on them. How have the folk of Clarez fared? What of your whites? He made a small sound.
I have lived a long life, Fitz Chivalry Farseer. I've seen the fall of the Pale Woman's holdings on Aslevyal, and rejoiced in it. Remember, I had my part in preserving Icefire's life while he was encased in the ice. But Clarez, here... Yes, they treated me badly. He looked down at the white tracery of scars on his black hands and arms. Worse than badly, he admitted. He lifted his eyes. As your own family treated you, as I recall from Beloved's telling. But never did you confuse one of your uncles with the others, did you? When I was a child at Clarez so long ago, it was a place of learning. I loved the libraries. They told me who I was. There were all the deeds of the white prophets who had gone before me. There were the adventures of them finding their catalysts, but also there were collections of lore and accounts of ancient queens, as well as maps and histories of faraway places. You cannot imagine what B destroyed with her fire. I do not blame her. She could not argue with the forces that shaped her and set her on that path. But I mourn what was lost. I mourn, too, the whites in their pretty little cottages, now buried under the fallen stone of Clarez Castle. Some were only children. Their dreams may have been used for selfish purposes, but you cannot blame them for that any more than I can blame B for what she became. So many of them are dead. So many. He fell silent, strangled by his emotions. I had no reply. Innocence had died. But those who had tormented and tortured the Fool, those who had stolen and abused my bee, they were dead too, and I could not regret that. So, the four are dead. What will become of you now? He lifted his eyes. The look he gave me was guarded. Three are dead. Capra survived. He studied my impassive face. Could he read my thoughts?
You and your dragons killed almost all of us. I have gathered 17 of the whites. Once there were over 200 whites and part whites. Those who survived take comfort in Capra's leadership. For generations, she has guided them. Already she tells us that the weakness was that there were four. She will be the one now, and will keep our purpose clear. I have spoken with her, and she has promised that we will all go back to our old ways. I set out to gather food for those who remain. But when I saw the piebald crow and called to her, and when she came to me, I knew my best course was to seek you out, to ask for mercy for those who remain, to diverge from your path just a little, for the sake of those under my protection. Was that why he had come? Or only now did he read my intent? I looked down at the emptied eggshells. Had he thought to buy me? "I could have poisoned you," he said, a slight edge in his voice in response to my silence. "No, you couldn't have. All those years when you raided the pale woman's food supplies, you never poisoned her. I know there is no killer in you, Prilcop. You should be glad of that. And it is a part of you that you can never tear from your soul." "That is likely. I brought you food. Can we not trade that for the lives of my whites?" I was silent, weighing that. He took my silence as a rejection of his offer. He stood abruptly. "I do not think we have ever truly been friends, Fitzchivalry Farseer." I came slowly to my feet. "I am sad to agree with you, Prilcop, but I give you my greatest respect. And I cede the same to you." He offered me a peculiar bow, one that involved stretching out one leg behind him. It was more stiff than graceful, and I suspect it cost the old man an effort. I returned a very formal buckkeep bow to him. And so we parted. I never saw Prilcop again. As the sun grew stronger, I took shelter in a thorn thicket. The bottle of wine was my companion. After I'd consumed it, I slept the rest of the day away. I woke hungry again, but in much better condition. Even my eyesight had improved, and Night Eyes remarked, "You see in the dark much as I once did. And as we once did, we hunt together." If Prilcop had warned Capra of danger, she had not heeded him. Perhaps he had judged me too feeble to pursue my prey immediately. Perhaps he had thought her well guarded. It was easy to find her. I ghosted through Clares until I found a large stone building where the debris had been cleared from the street and a new roof begun. She had a few guards, but I did not have to kill any of them. The guarded doors and windows faced the street front, but I went to the back of the building. Silently, my silver hand slowly eased away old stone and mortar. I made my own entrance. Somehow, they had found a fine bed for her. The tall wooden bedposts upheld lacy curtains. I woke her before I killed her. My grip silenced her, and I whispered to her startled eyes, "For my beloved, and for my bee, you die." It was my only indulgence. With silvered hands, I strangled her. My wit told me of her panic and pain and terror. But I killed her as if she were a rabbit. I did not delay her death, but I did look into her eyes until she was no longer behind them. I harked back to Shade's earliest training. I went in, I killed, and I departed. And I took her half-eaten chicken with me. It was delicious. As the sun rose, I was moving parallel to the road that led away from Clares. Chapter 41. Vivacia's Voyage. I mourn the good paper and lovely leather covers of the books my father gave to me.
they are gone, sent to the bottom with all the goods and possessions of those who captained and crewed Paragon. I do not miss the writing on those pages. The journal was written by a child, whom I barely recall. The dreams she wrote are irrelevant, markers on paths that no longer exist. The few that yet may be will come to pass with or without ink on a page. New dreams now come to me, and Beloved urges me to write them down. I do not like to call him Beloved, and when I called him Fool once, he flinched, and the captain of this ship looked at me as if I were rude. Before others, I call him Teacher. He does not seem to mind. I will not name him Amber. I no longer have a book, but Beloved has given me sheets of paper and a simple pen and black ink. I think he has begged these things from Captain Wintrow. This is my first dream to record. An old tree blossoms and bears a single beautiful fruit. It falls to the ground and rolls away. It cracks open, and a woman wearing a silver crown steps out of it. I am sad that I must draw this only in black on white paper. He has told me that he will read the dreams I write, that he must so that he can guide me. I write here what I have already told him, that he may read it again. I will not let my dreams be used to shape the world. And regardless of what he promised my father, I find it intrusive and rude that he reads my words here.
B. Farseer's Journal.
We put Clarez behind us, and I was not sorry to do so. The only tear I felt was that my father was left behind, dead and unburnt, in such a horrid place. The ship spoke in my mind the instant I set foot on the deck.
Who are you, and why do you ring so strangely on my senses?
I walled my mind as well as I could, but that only spiced her interest in me. She pushed at me, and it was like being prodded in the chest with a forefinger.
I don't know why you sense me. I am B. Farseer. I was a prisoner of the servants in Clarez. I only want to go home.
A very strange thing happened then. I felt the ship wall me out, but it was more relief than insult. We were a ragtag group that boarded Vivacia. The adults had already spoken to one another while I slept. It little mattered what they had agreed upon. I was like the nut carried in the stream. I was swept along by my fate. On board the ship, hammocks were hung for us, but there were no walls to divide us from the regular crew. I did not care. The moment my hammock was hung, I clambered into it and fell asleep. I woke shortly after to incredulous shouts from the deck. I forced myself to roll until I fell out of the hammock. I hurried from the crew quarters up onto the deck, fearing the ship was being attacked. The tide had carried some of the wreckage from Old Paragon out to sea, and clinging to it was a survivor. Spark's hopes were dashed when they hauled aboard a dazed and sunburnt woman. This was Boyo's mother and Brashen's wife, and she was somehow related to Captain Wintrow. The liveship thrummed with joy, the timbers vibrating. I stayed to see her brought aboard and given water, and then returned to my hammock. I cried, not with joy, but jealousy, and slept again. On this ship, Beloved became a person named Amber. I had no idea why he had so many names, or why he was now a woman. Everyone else seemed to accept it. I thought of how my father had been Tom Badgerlock, as well as Fitzchivalry Farseer, and perhaps I was the same. B. Badgerlock. B. Farseer. The Destroyer. B. The Orphan. 2 days into our voyage, I woke to Purr standing beside my hammock, looking at me.
Is there danger?
I asked, sitting up, and he caught me before I pitched to the deck again. It was not just the hammock. The ship was rolling.
No, but you have been sleeping a lot. You should get up and eat some food and move about.
When he mentioned food, my body asserted that it was hungry and very thirsty. He led me through the jungle of hammocks to a long table with benches alongside it. There were a few people sitting at it, finishing food, and a plate with a bowl covering it.
To keep it warm, Purr told me.
It was a thick stew that smelled strange,
yet was also good. Cinnamon, and a creamy but sour smell. Onions and potato pieces. The meat was mutton, Purr claimed, but it was not tough and stringy. Purr pushed a large bowl of boiled brown seeds toward me. It's rice. They tell me it grows in a swamp, and they harvest it in boats. Try it with the stew. It's good. I ate until my belly felt tight, and Purr had scraped the bottom of the big black kettle clean.
Want to come out on the deck now? He invited, but I shook my head.
I want to sleep, I told him. He frowned at that, but walked back to the hammock with me and helped me into it.
Are you sick, to sleep this much?
He asked me. I shook my head. It's easier than being awake, I told him, and closed my eyes. I woke again, but didn't open my eyes to hear them whispering about me.
But she sleeps so much. It's all she does.
Purr worried.
Let her sleep. It means she feels safe. She's getting the rest she didn't get the whole time they had her, and sorting things out. When I came back, when Fitz took me back to Buckkeep Castle, for many days after, I spent most of my time in sleep. It's the great healer.
Nonetheless, a few hours later when I opened my eyes, Purr was beside my hammock.
Are you awake enough to talk now? I want to know everything that has happened to you since last we were together, and I have much to tell you.
I have not so much to tell you. They stole me, and they dragged me to Clara's. They treated me badly. I stopped speaking. I didn't want to recount it for Perseverance, or anyone else. He nodded.
Not yet, then, but I shall tell you of all I have done and seen since you covered me with the butterfly cloak and left me in the snow.
I climbed out of the hammock, and we went out on the deck. It was a fine blue day. He took me to a place near the figurehead, but not in anyone's way. He told me his story, and it sounded to me like a tale of heroes on a quest. I wondered if Hap would ever make a song of it. I cried several times to hear of all my father and Purr had done to seek me. But they were good tears, as well as sad ones. In all the days when I had wondered why my father had not come to save me, I had wondered if he had ever loved me at all. I went back to my hammock and my sleep, knowing that he had. It was the ship that woke me the next time. She drilled through my walls.
Please help us. Come to me at the foredeck. You are needed.
I thought I would wake the others when I dropped and fell from the hammock to the deck. It was always dark below decks, but from the number of occupied hammocks around me, I guessed it was night. There was a single dim lantern swinging with the motion of the ship. I didn't like to look at it. I made my way through hammocks full of sleeping sailors like ripe fruit hanging on a tree, through shifting shadows to a ladder. I went up onto Vivacia's deck. The wind was blowing fresh, and I was suddenly glad to be awake. I looked up. The canvas was belled out like a rich merchant's belly, and beyond it were realms of stars in a clear sky. The deck of a sailing ship is never deserted when underway, but tonight's wind was steady and kind, so not many sailors were scurrying about. No one noticed me as I moved forward. There was a short set of steps, and then I was on the crowded foredeck. All sorts of lines terminated there. They were taut and humming a wind song. Past them was a smaller deck, a feature I'd never seen that poked out toward the figurehead. On that deck, a man was stretched out. As I stepped toward him cautiously, two other people stirred. I recognized one of them. Boyo's father, Captain Brashen Trell. Captain of nothing now, I guessed, and his son burned and still. I'd almost forgotten that we'd regained Boyo's mother. Her face and arms were pebbled. I stared, and then recognized that they were healing blisters from where the sun had burned her. She looked at my scarred face, and her brows drew together in pity. I looked away.
Her name is Althea Vestrit. If the past had been a bit different, she would be my captain now. Regardless of that, she is still of my liveship family, as is her son, and Trell served on my decks for many years, and I value him as well. What do you want of me?
I spoke the words aloud and in my mind. The ship didn't answer.
She's here.
Brashen Trell was wearily surprised.
Althea, this is the child I told you about. The one they came to rescue. She touched Boyo in Clares, and where she touched him, his burns healed.
Hello, B,
she said. Softly and sadly, she added,
I am sorry that you lost your father.
Thank you, I replied. Was it correct to thank someone for feeling bad about a death? I knew why the ship had summoned me now. Boyo smelled bad. When I knelt beside him, I felt how the ship cradled him. It was not that there was a hollow in her deck where she held him, but where he touched her wizard wood, she reminded him how to be alive and gave him gentle memories of his time on her deck. Memories that were not just his, but his mother's and his grandfather's and his great-grandmother's. All had sailed on this ship. Vivacia held all the memories of those who had died on her deck. That's why the dragons ate Kennetson, I said to myself.
Yes. Paragon's dragons ate Kennetson,
Althea asked in disbelief. They meant well by it. They wanted to keep him with them. They shared the body.
Oh.
She touched Boyo.
Did you need something?
She wanted me to leave. The ship asked me to come here. She wants me to help.
What can...
Althea began.
Shh!
Brashen warned her, for I had already put my hands on Boyo's good arm. I wanted to fix him. He was a wrong place on this perfect ship. I should make him right. He's thirsty, I told his parents.
He hasn't moved or spoken today.
He's thirsty, I insisted. Needed water if I was going to make anything happen. His mother seemed afraid to touch him as she lifted his head. She trickled water into his dry mouth. He choked a little, swallowed. That was my first way to help him. More water, I told her. She held the cup to his lips while I reminded him how to drink. He drank that cup and three more. Now I could move within him more easily. That salty soup that you make sometimes, it's yellow. That would be good. Even without opening my eyes, I knew they stared at me. The woman got up and hurried away. She was frightened, and she was eager to do anything that might help her son. She would make the soup. I rocked gently as my hands talked to his body. I found a little tune, one I'd never known before, and began to hum it as I worked. Two voices began to sing words to the song. The ship and the father sang softly together, and it was a little song about knots and sails, a teaching song, like my father's rhyme about the points one looked for in a good horse. I wondered, as I pushed dead skin and flesh away and fastened good skin, if every family and every trade had those little songs. I found a place where something that didn't belong in his body was trying to grow. I killed it and pushed it away. It slid away like slime, stinky and nasty. His body was working on itself in so many places. I knew them all. He had breathed in hot smoke, and it had hurt his throat and the breathing parts inside him. His arm was burnt, and his chest and the side of his face. What was the worst hurt? I asked his body, and it was his arm. I went to work there. His mother came back with the soup in a pot.
Oh, sweet sir!
She exclaimed. She was less fearful as she cradled his head and held the cup to his lips. It smelled wonderful, and I remembered how good it would taste, salty and a bit sour. He drank it down, and where I had worked on his throat, he could swallow now.
What goes on here? Amber, she's helping Boyo. She has to stop. She's only a child. How can you ask this of her? We didn't ask her. We were keeping a death watch with him. Then she came and put her hands on him. He's going to live. Boyo is going to live. But will she?
He was angry. Beloved was angry. No, frightened. He spoke to me now.
B, stop. You can't do this.
I drew a deep breath. Yes, I can, I told him as I breathed out.
No, you are giving him too much of your own strength. Lift your hands from him.
I smiled as I remembered words I had given my father. No one can say no to me now, not even you.
Be now,
I smiled. No.
Lift your hands, B, or I will pull you back from him.
Did he know that that would hurt both of us? A moment more, I told him, and heard the frustrated noise he made. I told Boyo's body to fare well, told it to keep working, gently, gently, gently. I had to go now, but it should keep working. Yes, we would give it more soup. It was like calming an animal, and I suddenly knew that Boyo's mind lived inside his animal body, and that was who I spoke to. I opened my eyes. Beloved reached toward me. I lifted my hands before he could touch me. I folded my arms on my chest and sat back. I hadn't realized how long I'd been crouching over Boyo. My back complained when I moved. I wiped my hands down my shirt. They were wet and sticky. Then I knew something.
Ship, you tricked me. You made me want to do this.
The carved woman turned slightly toward me.
It was necessary. She's a child,
Beloved objected.
You used her ruthlessly. I didn't realize,
Ration said, and he sounded both guilty and unrepentant. It didn't hurt me, I objected, but when I tried to stand up, I could not. The mother offered me a cup of the soup from the pot, and I drank it in long sips. There were warm spices in it, and some of them stung my tongue. Beloved watched me drink. Boyo was breathing, and it was a good sound. I set the cup down on the deck and said, The ship made me love her. I think it was like that thing dragons can do. I was suddenly very tired again. When they make themselves so important to someone, I read about that somewhere.
Humans call it a glamour,
the ship said quietly.
Your name is B. I give you thanks. At the end of this voyage, we will all go our separate ways. It grieved me that Althea and Brashen might have to go without their son. But he will live and go with them and be a comfort to them. And knowing that will be a comfort to me, I think, even as a dragon. As B should be a comfort to me, and Purr, and her sister Nettle. Sheep, interfere with this child again, and I shall— You have no threat to offer, Amber. Be still. She has done enough for Boyo. What would I ask again of her?
He had fallen silent, but I could see words piling up in him like unrecorded dreams. I will be fine, I assured them as I stood. I had to smile. Vivacia, you are as beautiful and perfect as you told me. I could love you. I was only a little tottery and very tired. Don't tell that. I'm going to go to sleep. Good night to all of you. Behind me, the adult spoke softly. My hearing has always been keen. Brashen spoke with regret.
She must have been a very pretty child once. Such scars, but thanks, Sar, she is here with us now. She has great heart. I beg you to be more careful of her. She is not strong. Not yet.
That was Beloved. He was wrong. I could be as strong as I needed to be. It bothered me that he tried to protect me, that he thought I was weak and tried to make others believe it as well. It made a hot little fire of anger in me. My legs trembled slightly as I made my way back to my hammock. I couldn't get into it. I thought of the first time I'd had to climb onto Priss's back, my horse. Purr was right. I'd be glad to see my horse again. When Beloved spoke, I startled.
Bee, that healing was a kind thing, but you must think first of your own health. You are not well yet. I won't ask you to promise me. But I will ask that you let me know if you're going to do something like that,
Someone must be with you who has your best interests at heart.
I do not think the ship would have let me go too far, I said. I smiled inside as I felt a warm, wordless reassurance that she would have stopped me. To him, I showed an expressionless face.
You are like your father. That isn't really an answer to my request.
He smiled, sad, but serious. I sighed. I wanted to sleep, not talk. Even more, I didn't want his concern for me. It wasn't his task. I found a lie. You needn't worry. My ability to do this is almost gone. The smile changed to a worried scowl.
What do you mean?
The night I fought Simph and Dwalia and Vindelia, Simph had a vial of serpent spit. What Dwalia called serpent potion. I think it had traces of silver in it, like the silver Paragon used to turn into dragons. I yawned wide. Suddenly I wanted to explain. In a dream I had, they got it from keeping a sea serpent in a very tiny pool of salt water. Simph was going to have Vindelia drink it. He had used it before, and it gave him great power. But when I set fire to Simph, she dropped the vial, and it broke. When I was stabbing her, I cut my feet on the glass, and some got into my blood. It made me stronger than Vindelia. I was so strong, I could just tell Dwalia to be dead. And she was. He went still. I watched him. Would he fear me now? Hate me? No. When he came back to himself, his eyes were sorrowful.
You set fire to Simph and stabbed her.
How could he think it sad that I had done that? I put it clearly. I told you when I told my father. I killed them. It wasn't evil, and I have no regret. It needed to be done. I was the one who was in the place and time to do it, and it was my task. So I did it. I should have killed Vindelia that night, too. It would have saved us a great deal of trouble.
Did you dream it?
He asked hesitantly. When I stared at him, he said,
Did you have a dream that killing them was something you were supposed to do?
I shrugged one shoulder. I seized the edge of the hammock, and this time I got into it. I pulled up my blanket. It was summer above, but below decks it was chill at night. I closed my eyes. I don't know. I have dreams. I know they mean something, but they are so strange I can't connect them to what I will do. I dreamed a silver man carving his heart. The serpent spit was silver. Was that a dream of me carving Dwalia's heart into death?
I don't think so, he said quietly.
That had been a recent dream. I felt better for having told someone. I'm going to sleep now, I told him. I closed my eyes and ignored him. He did not move. It was very annoying. I'd hoped he would leave. I waited a long time and then looked through my lashes. I was going to tell him to go away. Instead, I asked, Did you love my father? He went as still as a cat. When he spoke, it was with reservation.
I had a deep bond with your father, a connection I had with no one else.
Why won't you say you loved him? I opened my eyes to see his face. My father had given him all his strength, and this man would not even say he had loved him? His smile was too tight, as if he was forcing a different expression to be a smile.
It always made him uncomfortable if I used that word.
He did not use that word very much. His love was things he did.
He never counted up the things he did for me, but he always remembered the things I did for him.
So he loved you. Loved you so much, he left me to take you to Buckkeep. All expression fell away from his face. His peculiar eyes were empty. He wrote long letters to you, but he had nowhere to send them. He missed you desperately. He loved my mother, but he always had to be strong for her. He had Riddle, too, and my brother Hap. But the things he wrote about in those letters were things he could not say to my mother, nor Riddle, nor Hap. You left him, and all he could do was write them down. I watched him carefully and saw my barbed words hit and hold. I wanted to drive him away. I did not care that I hurt him. He was alive, and my father was dead. I added, "You should never have left him." His voice and face were expressionless.